I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'll speak with Sea Life Aquatist Trainer Knott. Trainer works for the Sea Life at the Mall of America in Minnesota. His sea creature friend, Seymour the Sea Turtle, has bubble butt syndrome, which means he's not able to pass gas on his own. Trainer and a group of students at the University of Minnesota are working to make Seymour's life more comfortable. And then, this week, I spend an evening at the Redlands Theater Festival, an outdoor theater located in Prospect Park. The play was the comedy Barefoot in the Park, written by Neil Simon. I spoke with lead actor Haley Rubin and the executive director, Shannon Galuska. My conversation with Trainer Knott and Shannon Galuska is coming up next, right after the NPR newscast. The simple things in life. This is Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. Trainer Knott is with Sea Life at Mall of America, and I'm so excited to talk to you about Seymour, the turtle that can't pass gas. Welcome to Lifestyles.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Seymour is a turtle and has bubble butt syndrome. Before this week, I'd never heard of bubble butt syndrome, let alone a turtle having it. So tell me, what is it?
Bubble butt syndrome is kind of a layman's name for a condition called positive buoyancy disorder. So when sea turtles get hit by boats, which is a pretty common occurrence, a lot of times they'll suffer spinal damage. They can suffer varying degrees of spinal damage, and in Seymour's case, she suffered just a little bit of spinal damage. It wasn't enough to impair mobility, but what it did do is it robbed her of the ability to push gas through her intestine. One thing with sea turtles is, you know, that they're marine animals and they have to be able to dive down below the surface of the water. So, you know, sort of like if we put on a life jacket, we couldn't really dive down below the surface very easily. And with sea turtles, if they have a bunch of gas inside of their intestines, they also can't dive down below the surface of the water. When turtles are unable to essentially fart and clear all this gas out of their lower intestines, they can't get rid of that extra buoyancy and dive down to do things like eat or evade predators or avoid boats. So bubble butt turtles are basically, they just kind of float at the surface and they're sort of stuck there.
And are they able to survive if they can't dive down to get food? Are they able to survive but just in a very uncomfortable way, or do they not make it?
So if a turtle has bubble butt, for the most part, it's a non-releasable turtle after its rehabilitation. It's simply because they can't evade predators. They can't dive down and get food. They're very vulnerable. And eventually, so when these turtles are floating, typically they're floating butt up and head down. And after a number of years of being in that position, then internal organs will actually shift and they'll put pressure on things like the heart and the lungs.
Oh.
And that'll cause further health complications, which, you know, if left untreated, a lot of times that's the demise of these animals, is basically they're just their hearts are overtaxed.
Got it. So now you and students with the University of Minnesota have come up with a plan or a prototype to help Seymour and others who may suffer from the lack of the ability to pass gas. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so essentially she has a plastic backpack on. The traditional method that we use to treat these turtles is we epoxy lead fishing weights to the shell. So if they're floating rear end high and head down, then we can apply 10, 15, 20 ounces of lead weights to the shell with epoxy, and that'll sort of level them out. And this method with the epoxy and the lead weights was developed by the Marathon Sea Turtle Hospital down the Florida Keys.
Okay.
It's a really good method for rescue and rehabilitation. But as far as long-term care, we've had Seymour for 9 years now. After 9 years, the epoxy just really isn't grabbing the shell like it should. We've kind of, through constant and repeated use, kind of used up a shell where these weights need to be epoxied on.
Okay.
So with the University of Minnesota, we got together and designed a plastic backpack that attaches to Seymour. It allows us to bolt the weights to the backpack as opposed to putting the epoxy on the shell to hold these weights on. And the 3D printed backpack still uses epoxy to hold it on, but it gives us this flexibility to move this epoxy around, where before, Seymour always needs weights in pretty much the same area, so we're forced to repeatedly use the same attachment site. But with this backpack, we can move all over her shell, and we don't have to overuse one site.
And so did you have to come up with a prototype to fit her specifically? Tell me a little bit about the process.
So the first thing we did is we got Seymour a CT scan. We took her to the University of Minnesota, where they have a CT machine that you can put a horse in. So we put her on the cart. They CT scanned her, which gave us basically an exact 3D copy of a digital copy.
Got it.
Then the engineers at University of Minnesota printed out a life-size 3D printed Seymour model, which they could kind of use as a bench model. So they kind of custom fit this shell based on this 3D scan that they got off of her.
So the 3D printer made this backpack or this apparatus that now goes on her shell, and does she need to change it often, or does it stay with her, or now what's the life of the backpack?
So we're still in the testing phases with it. She can wear it all day without any issues. And basically, how this 3D printed shell, we've been calling it the backpack or the exoshell, how it attaches is it kind of wraps around her shell just above her tail, and then this the front of the 3D printed shell, there's two Velcro attachment points. One thing that you have to keep in mind is Seymour lives in an aquarium, so there's a lot of fake corals and there's a lot of theming and stuff like that that provide possible entrapment hazards for her. So one of the things with designing the shell is we had to make sure that if she ever got tangled up in something in the tank, that she could break out of the shell. That way she wouldn't be pinned underwater and create a bigger situation.
Got it. Okay.
So this Velcro holds it on. So in theory, she can get out of it anytime she wants to, but she hasn't really, it doesn't seem to bother her at all, and we haven't really had any issues at all with it. Ideally, she can wear it until it falls off, and then we just kind of have to Velcro it back on.
And did she take to it right away as soon as you and the students created it and put it on her? Did she, when you put her back in the water, did she take to it or get it right away naturally?
And that was kind of a big question. I was afraid that we'd put this thing on her and she would kind of have this feeling that she was being chased, that something was grabbing her from behind, and she didn't seem to notice it at all. The first time we put it on, I kind of expected that we were going to put it on, and about 2 minutes later, she was going to rub it off on, you know, a piece of theming, and that would be it. But we put it on, she swam around the surface, and she ended up diving to the bottom of the tank, which was completely unexpected because we didn't have any weights attached to it. It was just the 3D printed plastic. And she's never really seemed to kind of acknowledge that it's there, which is a big win as far as what we were kind of going for.
Wow, that must have been an exciting time. It'd almost be like you putting a saddle on a horse that isn't ready and kind of bucking it off. That's what I thought she might have done, but she took to it and must have realized that it was for the good of her life rather than a bad thing.
Exactly. It was almost, it was kind of anticlimactically successful. You know, we kind of expected this big show and she just didn't even notice.
How was the experience for you or for the students?
This is the first time I've kind of delved into a project like this, and it would not have been possible without the University of Minnesota and more specifically the students over there. My lead designer specializes in 3D printing medical devices. So he's a grad student with the Institute for Engineering and Medicine. Basically, their bread and butter is if you have to have a very complicated surgery, these guys can CT scan you and then print out an exact copy of whatever your situation is so your surgeon can practice on this model before he actually does the surgery. So these guys, this was definitely in the wheelhouse, but they never necessarily expected to be doing a sea turtle conservation project using the skill set that they had. So they were very excited about it. It's what they refer to as a passion project, because most of these guys work off the clock. They work at night. They do this project just out of the desire to help and be involved with it. So these guys have been an absolute lifesaver with making this project possible.
That's wonderful. I'm speaking with Trainer Knott, a sea life aquatist at the Mall of America in Minnesota. Now, we're talking to you from Southern California, and so many of our listeners may not be familiar what sea life at the Mall of America is. What is it and what do they do?
So we're an aquarium in the basement of the Mall of America.
Oh.
As some of y'all may know, the Mall of America is, I think, the second largest mall in the country. It has an amusement park inside of it. It has an aquarium in the basement. So we operate this aquarium. We have a 300-foot tunnel. We have something like 50 sharks, 4 sea turtles, a pretty big array of marine life. So sometimes if you kind of need to get away from the hustle and bustle of shopping and amusement park rides, the aquarium's a pretty good kind of peaceful spot to step into and escape from the madness upstairs. So.
Now, in prepping for this interview, I read that you didn't start off as an aquatist there. You started off as a security guard. Tell me about your transition.
Yeah, I actually started as a security guard at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher.
Okay.
Working in aquariums was something I always wanted to do, but I never necessarily thought that it was going to be something that was possible for me. I wasn't the best student. My head was kind of in the clouds for the most part, and I kind of, you know, when I graduated high school, I kind of wandered around and didn't exactly know where my place was. So eventually, I landed as a security guard at North Carolina Aquarium.
Uh-huh.
I worked there for about 8 months. I transitioned to a different North Carolina Aquarium as a security guard. And then me and the curator there just kind of hit it off, and very graciously he gave me an opportunity to move into the husbandry department. So I got picked up as a husbandry assistant. After a couple of years, I actually met my wife there. She was the otter keeper. So I met my wife there. We got married. We had a couple of kids, and, you know, life kind of happened, and we ended up in Minnesota, and I'm working at an aquarium, and she's working at a computer database company that works with zoos and aquariums internationally, basically take the information that zoos and aquariums gather and apply it to real-world conservation situations. So it's been an unexpected journey, but it's been entertaining.
One that it seems you're proud of or pleased to be doing. Has this apparatus or this prototype backpack, have you shared it with other aquariums or other people like yourself that do this?
Yeah, I've given presentations at aquarium conferences in Tampa, in Seattle, and in Marathon, Florida, basically talking about my experiences developing it. And it's kind of taking the treatment of these turtles in a slightly different direction, but the main reason I like talking about it is I want to inspire other aquarists who have these ideas, and I want to show them that it's actually possible to get these ideas off the ground. You know, I never expected that this project would kind of get feet and take off. Kind of every step of the way, I sort of figured it would fizzle out and stop, but it didn't. And I think the big takeaway for me is, you know, if you have an idea and you pursue it, probably make it happen. That's kind of been one of the big subjects that I've tried to push when I'm speaking to groups of aquarists about this.
And when you speak to the groups, what has been their feedback or their comments and their excitement? I know when I watched the video, I was so tickled pink to see it. It was just so cool, something I would never think about, and why I was so interested in doing this interview. What have others said that you've spoken with?
There's actually been a lot of interest in it. Every aquarium that has sea turtles, the majority of sea turtles in captivity have bubble butt syndrome, and a lot of people struggle with this weight and epoxy method. So the people who work directly with the turtles are very interested in it. The curators who have to schedule these aquarius days are interested in it because it might be a time saver for them. And there are other solutions to this condition out there, like vests and harnesses, but each solution sort of has its own set of shortcomings.
Sure.
With this 3D printed backpack option, I was really trying to address a lot of those shortcomings, and I think it's really resonated with other aquarists. I have good dialogue with multiple other institutions that are interested in pursuing the concept for themselves.
Wonderful. Trainer, how is Seymour today?
She is good. In all honesty, she managed to break the exoshell, so she's not wearing it today. I'm in communications with the University of Minnesota, and we're probably going to be printing version 1.5 next week, which is basically just a little bit heavier duty model. When we originally designed it, we want to be very conservative with the weight, and now we realize that we can bump the weight up, which will in turn make it stronger. So she's not wearing it today, but she is temporarily weighted with the epoxy and lead weights, and she's just kind of being her happy self floating around the tank.
Beautiful. Trainer, it's been great speaking with you. Thank you for sharing your background and Seymour's as well.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for letting me share.
You can see Seymour with his apparatus at our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. Just click on today's show.
She was born by the sea, neath a gentle palm tree, in the pale blue light of the moon. Her small flippers fanned, and they clawed through the sand, till she found a tiny lagoon. The next day she ran, beyond the warm strand, to the cool lapping waves of the shore. She began a new life, in a blue paradise, in the deep sea.
After a quick break, I'll get out of the KVCR studio and visit the beautiful and quaint Prospect Park in the city of Redlands. It was a night at the theater, actually an outdoor theater. Don't go away. It's my conversation with Shannon Galuska, Executive Director of the Redlands Theater Festival. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez.
Swim with the tides and know you are free.
If you're just joining us, I'm getting out of the studio and heading to Redlands for an evening of theater and comedy.
The Redlands Theater Festival is located in Prospect Park in the heart of Redlands. Tonight's performance is Barefoot in the Park, written by Neil Simon. It's a romantic comedy focusing on a pair of newlyweds, Corey and Paul. In the movie, it was Robert Redford and Jane Fonda. Tonight's performance, the lead role, is Haley Rubin playing the part of Corey Bratter.
Did you miss me today?
No.
Why not?
Because you called me 8 times. I don't speak to you that much when I'm home.
You're grouchy. I want a divorce.
I'm not grouchy. I had a rotten day today.
Yeah.
A little tired, irritable,
yeah.
Cold, and grouchy.
Yeah. All right, I'll fix your drink, Grouch.
So, had you ever seen the movie Barefoot in the Park with Jane Fonda?
I did. I had heard about this show about a year and a half ago. I had a few people come up to me and say, oh, Barefoot in the Park would be a great show for you. I was like, what's that? And someone told me that there was a movie of it. So I went home and I watched the movie and I fell completely in love with it. I was like, I hope we get to do it. And then they announced the season for RTF and Barefoot in the Park was part of the season. And I was like, oh, please, I have to do that. Like, if you only cast me in one thing, please let it be Barefoot in the Park. Like, that's what I came here for this summer. It was this show and I'm glad I got it. Like, holy cow. It was awesome.
How did you feel after you completed it or even halfway through? What were you thinking?
It felt really, really good. It was nice to finally get an audience and to hear their responses and figuring out when we're supposed to pause for laughter, because we've spent, you know, a couple months with the show already that we kind of don't realize where the laughs are going to be anymore. So we were definitely ready for an audience, for sure. I was definitely very nervous in the first act, but my cast is so amazing. I knew that I was in safe hands. I knew the audience was having a good time, so I was able to just kind of let the nerves go and make it through the rest of the show just having fun. This is such a fun show. Like, how could you not have fun doing it? Even with all of the nerves, just the script is so beautiful and the staging is so fun. And
have you performed here at RTF before? I've been in the company before?
Yes, this is my third season with RTF, and this year I'm an official company member. Just performed last year and the year before in shows. 3 shows. I do 3 shows every time.
Thanks.
Shannon Galuska is the executive director of the Redlands Theater Festival, a title that has been passed down to her from her dad.
So tell me a little bit about RTF, what it is, and how it all began.
RTF is the brainchild of Cliff Cabanella, my dad. This is our 47th season. He started it when he was hired at Crafton Hills College for the theater department, which he ran for, I think, 38 years. We were a little offshoot of their theater department.
So you kind of grew up on these grounds.
Yeah. My first show was Carousel when I was 5, and I took 2 summers off when I went away to school.
So what's your role now?
So I've basically taken over for my dad. He is still here as a consultation type person, and he still knows all the things that we need to do. But this year has really been a transition year as far as him being ready to step down and passing the baton to me.
And what have you learned that your dad probably did flawlessly and you didn't maybe understand all the things? I mean, you grew up here, so you did know, but what have you learned taking on this role?
Well, at first you have all kinds of great ideas about how to make things better and, oh, we should do it this way or that way, and why do you do it this way? And what I found out is that he was right about everything, and the guy just knew what he was doing when he set this whole thing up. And it's not perfect, and it may not work for other companies, but it's perfect for our company, and we want to try to stick to our original model as much as possible and keep the tradition going. And
for someone who's never been here, maybe further away than the Inland Empire, describe what it is. Paint a picture. You know, this is radio.
Basically, we're in the middle of a gorgeous botanical garden on the corner of Cajon and Highland. From the street, you have no idea what you're coming into. Drive up Cajon and park on the street, and you enter into this kind of magical forest. We're surrounded by eucalyptus and bamboo and all kinds of indigenous plants. But you come into this little sacred area that opens up into this beautiful theater that my dad and Leon Armand Trout created, and it just kind of melts into the scenery seamlessly.
Tell me about your company. What shows you're doing this summer in repertoire?
So I think this summer might be our biggest company ever. I think we have about 90 people. We do 5 shows in repertory. Present Laughter by Noel Coward, and that was great opening. Barefoot in the Park by Neil Simon. We also have the Robber Bridegroom musical and the Addams Family musical and Midsummer Night's Dream. And we do a different show every night. So no particular order. We take down the set every night, put up a new one, continue on.
You typically do a musical. Musicals tend to be the breadwinners in that people all want to go see musicals, but you always do a farce, or what's your kind of your protocol that you follow?
Oh, okay. So our formula would be usually a big musical, a smaller musical, a period play, something modern, contemporary, and usually kind of a wild card, just about anything for the fifth.
You've also had the experience over the years for directing some of the shows. How has your role changed as a director and to where you are handing it to other directors?
So this year I'm lucky I get to direct 2 plays, The Robber Bridegroom and Present Laughter. Totally different, wildly different plays. And I'm actually not performing this year for the first time since 2005. So that's different for me, but it's just a lot to oversee. And I'm also really overseeing the other 2 plays too, except for Addams Family is kind of my break. That's the one that Candace, my sister, is directing, yes.
Is it different for you not to be performing and not to be on stage? Are you doing okay backstage and just calling the shots?
We'll see. I'm not sure how that's going to feel yet. I was a little bit sad, I guess, that I was not going to be able to do that this year. But I'm kind of relieved, too, because it's one less thing to worry about. And there's so many other things going on.
So this is really a family affair. You mentioned your sister, and your husband is kind of involved as well, is he not?
Yes, he is. Dennis Galuska. He really runs the live music portion of the festival, and both of our musicals have live musicians, which we are super excited. And he also is a master carpenter, and he kind of takes care of the grounds for us and the facility and the tram. We all kind of have a lot of different roles up here.
Your mom has played a huge role in RTF over the years, and is she involved this year?
Just on the sidelines. She's just rooting us on. She and my dad wanted to take this summer to travel a little bit and just have time off together. So she's supporting in the wings.
And lastly, what would you tell someone that's never been here why to come?
It's like this hidden gem, and we wish more people knew about it. We hear all the time, I've lived here for 30 years, and I never knew this was here. And we would just love to share this with more people. So tell your friends and come on up. We're open almost every single night through July 27th.
The Redlands Theater Festival season runs now through July 27th. For the season schedule, go to our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on Today's Show. That's our show. To hear any past interviews or segments, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. While you're on our page, leave me a message or a suggestion of a topic that interests you. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including David Fleming, Sharina Wadd, Sean Houlihan, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Ethan Bortnick provides our theme music. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.